"What is this place?" said Kanina. Rincewind looked around him and made a guess. They were still in the heart of Al-Khali. He could hear the hum of it beyond the walls, but in the middle of the teeming city someone had cleared a vast space, walled it off, and planted a garden so romantically natural that it looked as real as a sugar pig. "It looks like someone has taken twice 5 miles of inner city and girded them round with walls and towers," he hazarded. "What a strange idea," said Kanina. "Well, some of the religions here... Well, when you die, you see, they think you go to this sort of garden where there's all this sort of music, and," he continued wretchedly, "sherbet and young women." Kanina took in the green splendour of the walled garden with its peacocks, intricate arches and slightly wheezy fountains. A dozen reclining women stared back at her impassively. A hidden string orchestra was playing the complicated Klatchian bong music. "I'm not dead," she said. "I'm sure I would have remembered. Besides, this isn't my idea of paradise." She looked critically at the reclining figures and added, "I wonder who does their hair." A sword point prodded her in the small of the back, and the two of them set out along the ornate path towards a small domed pavilion surrounded by olive trees. She scowled. "Anyway, I don't like sherbet." Rincewind didn't comment. He was busily examining the state of his own mind, and wasn't happy at the sight of it. He had a horrible feeling that he was falling in love. He was sure he had all the symptoms. They were the sweaty palms, the hot sensation in the stomach, the general feeling that the skin on his chest was made of tight elastic. There was the feeling every time Kanina spoke that someone was running hot steel into his spine. He glanced down at the luggage, tramping stoically alongside him, and recognised the symptoms. "Not you too," he said. Possibly it was only the play of sunlight on the luggage's battered lid, but it was just possible that for an instant it looked redder than usual. Of course, sapient Pearwood has this sort of weird mental link with its owner. Rincewind shook his head. Still, it had explained why the thing wasn't its normal malignant self. "It'd never work," he said. "I mean, she's a female, and, well, you're..." He paused. "Well, whatever you are, you're of the wooden persuasion. It'd never work. People would talk." He turned and glared at the black-robed guards behind him. "I don't know what you're looking at," he said severely. The luggage sidled over to Kanina, following her so closely that she banged an ankle on it. "Push off," she snapped, and kicked it again, this time on purpose. Insofar as the luggage ever had an expression, it looked at her in shocked betrayal. The pavilion ahead of them was an ornate onion-shaped dome, studded with precious stones and supported on 4 pillars. Its interior was a mass of cushions on which lay a rather fat middle-aged man surrounded by 3 young women. He wore a purple robe, interwoven with gold thread. They, as far as Rincewind could see, demonstrated that you could make 6 small saucepan lids and a few yards of curtain netting go a long way, although, he shivered, not really far enough. The man appeared to be writing. He glanced up at them.
"I suppose you don't know a good rhyme for thou," he said peevishly.
Rincewind and Kanina exchanged glances.
"Plough?" said Rincewind. "Bow?"
"Cow?" suggested Kanina with forced brightness. The man hesitated.
"Cow, I quite like," he said. "Cow has got possibilities. Cow might, in fact, do. Do pull up a cushion, by the way, have some sherbet. Why are you standing there like that?"
"It's these ropes," said Kanina. "I have this allergy to cold steel," Rincewind added.
"Really, how tiresome," said the fat man, and clapped a pair of hands so heavy with rings that the sound was more of a clang.
2 guards stepped forward smartly and cut the bonds, and then the whole battalion melted away, although Rincewind was acutely conscious of dozens of dark eyes watching them from the surrounding foliage. Animal instinct told him that while he now appeared to be alone with the man and Kanina, any aggressive moves on his part would suddenly make the world a sharp and painful place. He tried to radiate tranquillity and total friendliness. He tried to think of something to say. "Well," he ventured, looking around at the brocaded hangings, the ruby-studded pillars and the gold filigree cushions. "You've done this place up nicely. It's... He sought for something suitably descriptive. "Well, pretty much of a miracle of rare device."
"One aims for simplicity," sighed the man, still scribbling busily. Why are you here?
Not that it isn't always a pleasure to meet fellow students of the poetic muse.
We were brought here, said Canina.
Men with swords, added Rincewind.
Dear fellows, they do so like to keep in practice. Would you like one of these?
He snapped his fingers at one of the girls. Not right now, Rincewind began, but she'd picked up a plate of golden brown sticks and demurely passed it towards him. He tried one. It was delicious, a sort of sweet, crunchy flavour with a hint of honey. He took two more.
Excuse me, said Canina, but who are you, and where is this?
My name is Creosote, Serif of Alkali, said the fat man, and this is my wilderness. One does one's best.
Rincewind coughed on his honey stick. Not Creosote as in as rich as Creosote, he said.
That was my dear father. I am, in fact, rather richer. When one has a great deal of money, I'm afraid it is hard to achieve simplicity. One does one's best, he sighed.
You could try giving it away, said Canina.
He sighed again.
That isn't easy, you know. No, one just has to try to do a little with a lot.
No, but look, said Rincewind, spluttering bits of stick. They say, I mean, everything you touch turns into gold, for goodness sake.
That could make going to the lavatory a bit tricky, said Canina brightly.
Sorry.
One hears such stories about oneself, said Creosote, affecting not to have heard. So tiresome, as if wealth mattered. True riches lie in the treasure houses of literature.
The Creosote I heard of, said Canina slowly, was head of this band of, mad killers. The original assassins, feared throughout Hubwood Clatch. No offence meant.
Ah, yes, dear father, said Creosote Junior. The Hashishim. Such a novel idea.
The Hashishim, who derived their name from the vast quantities of hashish they consumed, were unique among vicious killers in being both deadly and at the same time inclined to giggle, groove to interesting patterns of light and shade on their terrible knife blades, and, in extreme cases, fall over.
But not really very efficient, so we hired thugs instead.
Ah, named after a religious sect, said Canina knowingly.
Creosote gave her a long look.
No, he said slowly. I don't think so. I think we named them after the way they push people's faces through the back of their heads. Dreadful, really.
He picked up the parchment he had been writing on and continued.
I see a more cerebral life, which is why I had the city centre converted into a wilderness. So much better for the mental flow. One does one's best. May I read you my latest oeuvre?
Egg, said Rincewind, who wasn't following this.
Creosote thrust out one pudgy hand and declaimed as follows.
A summer palace underneath the bough. A flask of wine, a loaf of bread, some lamb couscous with courgettes, roast peacock tongues, kebabs iced sherbet, selection of sweets from the trolley, and choice of thou. Singing beside me in the wilderness, and wilderness is...
He paused and picked up his pen thoughtfully.
Maybe cow isn't such a good idea, he said, now that I come to look at it.
Rincewind glanced at the manicured greenery, carefully arranged rocks and high surrounding walls. One of the vows winked at him. This is a wilderness, he said.
My landscape gardeners incorporated all the essential features, I believe. They spent simply ages getting the rills sufficiently sinuous. I am reliably informed that they contain prospects of rugged grandeur and astonishing natural beauty.
And scorpions, said Rincewind, helping himself to another honey stick.
I don't know about that, said the poet. Scorpions sound unpoetic to me. Wild honey and locusts seem more appropriate, according to the standard poetic instructions, although I've never really developed the taste for insects.
I always understood that the kind of locust people ate in the wildernesses was the fruit of a kind of tree, said Canina. Father always said it was quite tasty.
Not insects, said Creosote.
I don't think so.
The Seraph nodded at Rincewind.
"You might as well finish them up, then," he said. "Nasty, crunchy things. I couldn't see the point."
"I don't wish to sound ungrateful," said Kanina, over the sound of Rincewind's frantic coughing, "but why did you have us brought here?"
"Good question," Creosote looked at her blankly for a few seconds, as if trying to remember why they were there. "You really are a most attractive young woman," he said. "You can't play a dulcimer by any chance?"
"How many blades has it got?" said Kanina.
"Pity," said the Seraph. "I had one specially imported."
"My father taught me to play the harmonica," she volunteered. Creosote's lips moved soundlessly as he tried out the idea.
"No good," he said. "Doesn't scan. Thanks all the same, though."
He gave her another thoughtful look.
"You know, you really are most becoming. Has anyone ever told you your neck is as a tower of ivory?"
"Never," said Kanina.
"Pity," said Creosote again.
He rummaged among his cushions and produced a small bell, which he rang. After a while, a tall, saturnine figure appeared from behind the pavilion. He had the look of someone who could think his way through a corkscrew without bending, and a certain something about the eyes which would have made the average rabid rodent tiptoe away, discouraged. "That man, you would have said, has got Grand Vizier written all over him. No one can tell him anything about defrauding widows and imprisoning impressionable young men in alleged jewel caves. When it comes to dirty work, he probably wrote the book, or more probably stole it from someone else. He wore a turban with a pointy hat sticking out of it. He had a long, thin moustache. Of course."
"Ah, Abrim," said Creosote.
"Highness?"
"My Grand Vizier," said the Seraph.
"Thought so," said Rincewind to himself.
"These people, why did we have them brought here?"
The Vizier twirled his moustache, probably foreclosing another dozen mortgages.
"The hat, Highness," he said. "The hat, if you remember."
"Ah, yes, fascinating. Where did we put it?"
"Hold on," said Rincewind urgently. "This hat, it wouldn't be a sort of battered, pointy one with lots of stuff on it. Sort of lace and stuff, and he hesitated. "No one's tried to put it on, have they?"
"It specifically warned us not to," said Creosote. "So Abrim got a slave to try it on, of course. He said it gave him a headache."
"It also told us that you would shortly be arriving,"
said the Vizier, bowing slightly at Rincewind,
"and therefore I, that is to say, the Seraph, felt that you might be able to tell us more about this wonderful artifact."
There is a tone of voice known as interrogative, and the Vizier was using it. A slight edge to his words suggested that if he didn't learn more about the hat very quickly, he had various activities in mind in which further words like red hot and knives would appear. Of course, all Grand Viziers talk like that all the time. There's probably a school somewhere.
"Gosh, I'm glad you found it," said Rincewind. "That hat is..."
"I beg your pardon?"
said Abrim, signalling a couple of lurking guards to step forward.
"I missed the bit after the young lady," he elbowed at Kanina, "elbowed you in the ear."
"I think," said Kanina, politely but firmly, "you'd better take us to see it." 5 minutes later, from its resting place on the table in the Seraph's treasury, the hat said,
"At last! What kept you?"
It is at a time like this, with Rincewind and Kanina probably about to be the victims of a murderous attack, and Coin about to address the assembled and cowering wizards on the subject of treachery, and the disc about to fall under a magical dictatorship, that it is worth mentioning the subject of poetry and inspiration. For example, the Seraph, in his Bijou Wilderness-et, has just riffled back through the pages of verse to revise the lines which begin, "Get up, for morning in the cup of day has dropped the spoon that scares the stars away." And he has sighed because the white-hot lines searing across his imagination never seem to come out exactly as he wants them. It is, in fact, impossible that they ever will. Sadly, this sort of thing happens all the time. It is a well-known and established fact throughout the many-dimensional worlds of the multiverse that most really great discoveries are owed to one brief moment of inspiration. There's a lot of spadework first, of course, but what clinches the whole thing is the sight of, say, a falling apple, or a boiling kettle, or the water slopping over the edge of the bath. Something goes click inside the observer's head, and then everything falls into place. The shape of DNA, it is popularly said, owes its discovery to the chance sight of a spiral staircase when the scientist's mind was just at the right receptive temperature. Had he used the lift, the whole science of genetics might have been a good deal different. Although possibly quicker, and only licensed to carry 14 people. This is thought of as somehow wonderful. It isn't. It is tragic. Little particles of inspiration sleet through the universe all the time, travelling through the densest matter in the same way that a neutrino passes through a candy floss haystack, and most of them miss. Even worse, most of the ones that hit the exact cerebral target hit the wrong one. For example, the weird dream about a lead donut on a mile-high gantry, which in the right mind would have been the catalyst for the invention of repressed gravitational electricity generation, a cheap and inexhaustible and totally non-polluting form of power which the world in question had been seeking for centuries, and for the lack of which it was plunged into a terrible and pointless war, was in fact had by a small and bewildered duck. By another stroke of bad luck, the sight of a herd of white horses galloping through a field of wild hyacinths would have led a struggling composer to write the famous Flying God Suite, bringing succour and balm to the souls of millions, had he not been at home in bed with shingles. The inspiration, therefore, fell to a nearby frog, who was not in much of a position to make a startling contribution to the field of tone poetry. Many civilizations have recognized this shocking waste, and tried various methods to prevent it, most of them involving enjoyable but illegal attempts to tune the mind into the right wavelength by the use of exotic herbage or yeast products. It never works properly. And so Creosote, who had dreamt the inspiration for a rather fine poem about life and philosophy and how they both look much better through the bottom of a wine glass, was totally unable to do anything about it because he had as much poetic ability as a hyena. Why the gods allow this sort of thing to continue is a mystery. Actually, the flash of inspiration needed to explain it clearly and precisely has taken place, but the creature who received it, a small female blue tit, has never been able to make the position clear, even after some really strenuous coded message on the tops of milk bottles. By a strange coincidence, a philosopher who had been devoting some sleepless nights to the same mystery woke up that morning with a wonderful new idea for getting peanuts out of bird tables. Which brings us rather neatly onto the subject of magic. A long way out in the dark gulfs of interstellar space, one single inspiration particle is clipping along, unaware of its destiny, which is just as well, because its destiny is to strike, in a matter of hours, a tiny area of Rincewind's mind. It would be a tough destiny, even if Rincewind's creative node was a reasonable size. But the particle's karma had handed it the problem of hitting a moving target the size of a small raisin over the distance of several hundred light-years. Life can be very difficult for a little subatomic particle in a great big universe. If it pulls it off, however, Rincewind will have a serious philosophic idea. If it doesn't, a nearby brick will have an important insight which it will be totally unequipped to deal with. The Serif's palace, known to legend as the Roxy, occupied most of the centre of Al-Khali that wasn't occupied by the wilderness. Most things connected with Creosote were famed in mythology, and the arched, domed, many-pillared palace was said to have more rooms than any man had been able to count. Rincewind didn't know which number he was in.
"It's magic, isn't it?"
said Abrim the vizier. He prodded Rincewind in the ribs.
"You're a wizard," he said. "Tell me what it does."
"How do you know I'm a wizard?" said Rincewind desperately.
"It's written on your hat," said the vizier. "Ah, and you were on the boat with it. My men saw you."
"The Serif employs slavers," snapped Kanina. "That doesn't sound very simple."
"Oh, I employ the slavers. I am the vizier, after all," said Abrim. "It is rather expected of me."
He gazed thoughtfully at the girl and then nodded at a couple of the guards.
"The current Serif is rather literary in his views,"
he said. I, on the other hand, am not. Take her to the Seraglio, although, he rolled his eyes and gave an irritable sigh, I'm sure the only fate that awaits her there is boredom and possibly a sore throat.
He returned to Rincewind.
Don't say anything, he said. Don't move your hands. Don't try any sudden feats of magic. I am protected by strange and powerful amulets.
Now, just hold on a minute, Rincewind began, and Kanina said, All right, I've always wondered what a harem looked like. Rincewind's mouth went on opening and shutting, but no sounds came out. Finally, he managed, Have you? She waggled an eyebrow at him. It was probably a signal of some sort. Rincewind felt he ought to have understood it, but peculiar passions were stirring in the depths of his being. They weren't actually going to make him brave, but they were making him angry. Speeded up, the dialogue behind his eyes was going something like this.
Who's that?
Your conscience. I feel terrible. Look, they're marching her off to the harem.
Rather her than me, thought Rincewind, but without much conviction.
Do something. There's too many guards. They'll kill me.
So they'll kill you. It's not the end of the world.
It will be for me, thought Rincewind grimly.
But just think how good you'll feel in your next life.
Look, just shut up, will I? I've had just about enough of me.
Abrim stepped across to Rincewind and looked at him curiously.
Who are you talking to?
He said.
I warn you, said Rincewind between clenched teeth, I have this magical box on legs which is absolutely merciless with attackers. One word from me and...
I'm impressed, said Abrim. Is it invisible?
Rincewind risked a look behind him.
I'm sure I had it when I came in, he said, and sagged.
It would be mistaken to say that the luggage was nowhere to be seen. It was somewhere to be seen. It was just that the place wasn't anywhere near Rincewind.
Abrim walked slowly around the table on which sat the hat, twirling his moustache.
Once again, he said, I ask you. This is an artifact of power. I feel it. And you must tell me what it does.
Why don't you ask it? Said Rincewind.
It refuses to tell me.
Well, what do you want to know?
Abrim laughed. It wasn't a nice sound. It sounded as though he had had laughter explained to him, probably slowly and repeatedly, but had never heard anyone actually do it.
You're a wizard, he said. Wizardry is about power.
I have taken an interest in magic myself. I have the talent, you know.
The vizier drew himself up stiffly.
Oh, yes, but they wouldn't accept me at your university. They said I was mentally unstable. Can you believe that?
No, said Rincewind, truthfully. Most of the wizards at the Unseen had always seemed to him to be several bricks short of a shilling. Abrim seemed pretty normal wizard material.
Abrim gave him an encouraging smile. Rincewind looked sideways at the hat. It said nothing. He looked back at the vizier. If the laughter had been weird, the smile made it sound as normal as birdsong. It looked as though the vizier had learned it from diagrams.
Wild horses wouldn't get me to help you in any way, he said.
Ah, said the vizier, a challenge. He beckoned the nearest guard.
Do we have any wild horses in the stables?
Some fairly angry ones, master.
Infuriate four of them, and take them to the Turnwise courtyard, and bring several lengths of chain.
Right away, master.
Look, said Rincewind.
Yes,
said Abrim. Well, if you put it like that...
You wish to make a point?
It's the Arch-Chancellor's hat, if you must know, said Rincewind, the symbol of wizardry.
Powerful?
Rincewind shivered.
Derry, he said. Why is it called the Arch-Chancellor's hat?
The Arch-Chancellor is the most senior wizard, you see. The leader. But, look.
Abrim picked up the hat and turned it around and around in his hands.
It is, you might say, the symbol of office?
Absolutely, but look, if you put it on, I'd better warn you.
Oh, shut up!
Abrim leapt back, the hat dropping to the floor.
The wizard knows nothing. Send him away. We must negotiate.
The vizier stared down at the glittering octarines around the hat.
I negotiate with an item of apparel?
I have much to offer.
on the right head? Rincewind was appalled. It has already been indicated that he had the kind of instinct for danger usually found only in certain small rodents, and it was currently battering on the side of his skull in an attempt to run away and hide somewhere.
"Don't listen," he shouted.
"Put me on,"
said the Hat, beguilingly, in an ancient voice that sounded as though the speaker had a mouthful of felt. If there really was a school for viziers, Abrim had come top of the class.
"We'll talk first," he said.
He nodded at the guards and pointed to Rincewind.
"Take him away and throw him in the spider tank," he said.
"No, not spiders on top of everything else," moaned Rincewind.
The captain of the guard stepped forward and knuckled his forehead respectively.
"Run out of spiders, master," he said.
"Oh."
The vizier looked momentarily blank.
"In that case, lock him in the tiger cage."
The guard hesitated, trying to ignore the sudden outburst of whimpering beside him.
"The tiger's been ill, master. Backwards and forwards all night."
"Then throw this snivelling coward down the shaft of eternal fire."
A couple of the guards exchanged glances over the head of Rincewind, who had sunk to his knees.
We'll need a bit of notice of that, master.
To get it going again, like."
The vizier's fist came down hard on the table. The captain of the guards brightened up horribly.
There's the snake pit, master," he said.
The other guards nodded. There was always the snake pit. Four heads turned towards Rincewind, who stood up and brushed the sand off his knees.
"How do you feel about snakes?"
said one of the guards. "Snakes? I don't like snakes much."
"This snake pit,"
said Abrim.
"Right, the snake pit,"
agreed the guards. "I mean, some snakes are okay,"
Rincewind continued, as two guards grabbed him by the elbows. In fact, there was only one very cautious snake, which remained obstinately curled up in a corner of the shadowy pit, watching Rincewind suspiciously, possibly because he reminded it of a mongoose.
"Hi,"
it said eventually.
"Are you a wizard?"
As a line of snake dialogue, this was a considerable improvement on the normal string of S's. But Rincewind was sufficiently despondent not to waste time wondering, and simply replied, "It's on my hat. Can't you read?"
"In 17 languages, actually. I taught myself."
"Really?"
"I sent off for courses. But I try not to read, of course. It's not in character."
"I suppose it wouldn't be."
It was certainly the most cultured snake voice that Rincewind had ever heard.
"It's the same with the voice, I'm afraid,"
the snake added.
"I shouldn't really be talking to you now. Not like this, anyway. I suppose I could grunt a bit. I rather think I should be trying to kill you, in fact."
"I have curious and unusual powers," said Rincewind.
Fair enough, he thought. An almost total inability to master any form of magic is pretty unusual for a wizard. And anyway, it doesn't matter about lying to a snake.
"Gosh, well, I expect you won't be in here long, then."
"Hmm?"
"I expect you'll be levitating out of here like a shot any minute."
Rincewind looked up at the 15-foot-deep walls of the snake pit and rubbed his bruises.
"I might," he said cautiously.
"In that case, you wouldn't mind taking me with you, would you?"
"Eh?"
"It's a lot to ask, I know, but this pit is... well, it's the pits."
"Take you? But you're a snake. It's your pit. The idea is that you stay here and people come to you. I mean, I know about these things."
A shadow behind the snake unfolded itself and stood up.
"That's a pretty unpleasant thing to say about anyone,"
it said. The figure stepped forward into the pool of light. It was a young man, taller than Rincewind. That is to say, Rincewind was sitting down, but the boy would have been taller than him even if he was standing up. To say that he was lean would be to miss a perfect opportunity to use the word emaciated. He looked as though toast racks and deck chairs had figured in his ancestry, and the reason it was obvious was his clothes. Rincewind looked again.
He had been right first time. The lank-haired figure in front of him was wearing the practically traditional garb for barbarian heroes. A few studded leather thongs, big furry boots, a little leather hold-all, and goose pimples. There was nothing unusual about that. You'd see a score of similarly dressed adventurers in any street of Ankh-Morpork. Except that you'd never see another one wearing... The young man followed his gaze, looked down, and shrugged.
"I can't help it," he said. "I promised my mother."
"Woolly underwear?"